The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WISO. Hope you are having a good holiday weekend. And stay tuned. We've got Melissa Faye Greene coming your way, recorded back in 2003 with a very amazing story. It's nonfiction. It's called The Last Man Out, the story of the Spring Hill mine disaster. We call it the best of the Book Nook. Melissa, tell us about Spring Hill, about this community in this area.
It's a town kind of in the middle of the province. It sits on a hill of coal. There are these great tours you can take around Nova Scotia, but this isn't on them, since Spring Hill's not on those tours. Little town, it existed for coal mining. The deepest coal mine in North America was there. It was called the Number 2 Slope. It was built like the letter E, kind of like the Enron E, although that's gone ahead and fallen over now. But if you can just picture going down the back of the E, that was the slope. And then the arms coming off the letter E were called levels. And the miners worked on those levels, bringing out the coal. And again, it was about 2.5 miles from the pit head as you drove down the slope, down the back of the E. And if you came down vertically, it was a mile. So they worked a mile underground. The coal field there was prone to bumping, as they called it. And the pressure deep within the earth built up to such an extent that it would rattle the mine. What one of the wives told me was, you know, if you bake an angel food cake, then you're going to test it with just a cake tester with a single prong. You're not going to stick a whole fork into it because, you know, 3 or 4 prongs could make the cake exhale and collapse. That was what this mine, this is what was going on. It was like a fork, this letter E, digging into the mine, and it was weakening all the rock walls that held the mine open with air pockets. So what happened on October 23rd, 1958, was just after 8 o'clock in the evening, the off-shift miners and their families were seated in front of their TVs watching I Love Lucy. Men were underground all the time. There were 3 shifts a day. There was always someone underground. I mentioned in the book that the mine is kind of like the common basement under the town. If you've got a day when you're home and plumbers come over and they're down in your basement rummaging around, and maybe you forget about them, but every once in a while when you walk across the linoleum, you feel things thumping under there, and maybe the lights dim, and you remember these guys are in the basement. That's, Spring Hill was like that. It was like it was built over this basement of coal. So suddenly there's this huge boom. And what's happened is that the pressure at the core of the earth has shoved the bottom floor up into the next floor with just a slamming bang. First, people had these homely thoughts. A woman thought her refrigerator had fallen over. Another woman thought a truck had hit the side of the house. A dad yelled upstairs to the kids, "Stop horsing around!" But then it goes again, boom, and then again, boom. It registered in Halifax as an earthquake. It was felt by ships at sea. After 3 booms, everyone knew it was a bump, and it sounded like the 3 levels had gone. So everyone in town just took off for the mine and massed at the pit head, you know, desperate for news. There were men who had been higher up on the slope on the back of that letter E, and they were able to walk out, and they came out just, you know, blackened and dazed. But the men who had been on the levels deep in the mine did not come out.
And this was the afternoon shift working, and there were about 170-some that were trapped or killed.
Right.
And this was nothing new. They had lots of disasters. In fact, 2 years before, didn't they have quite a little disaster?
Yes. In 1956, it was a different kind of a disaster. It was a gas explosion. The men rode to work each day on these coal cars that went down on tracks down the slope, down the back of this letter E. This disaster in 56 happened in the Number 4 mine. You just have to picture a roller coaster, how steep the ascent was out of the mine. So they came up on this coal car, which was towed out by a hoist on the surface. They got out of it, and then the coal car, this little train car, broke loose and went flying back down the tracks into the mine, again, if you could imagine a roller coaster and the cars just rolling back down the steepest slope, and the cars took off and hit the roof of the mine and dashed off sparks, and the sparks ignited this methane gas that stands in a coal mine, and it exploded like a mushroom cloud. It just came billowing out the mouth of the mine. It was seen all over town. It blew men sky high. It was a terrible disaster. And in 56, men were trapped, but they weren't trapped as in 58 by rock and coal. They were just trapped by poison gas, which was invisible, and it blocked their path, but they could see their way out. They could see the way to walk up to get home, but there was this gas between them and the exit. The old-timers knew not to go out. The old-timers could taste it. They said it was like if you bite down on a paperclip, a sort of metallic tang in your mouth, but the younger guys could see their way out, and a couple of the younger guys tried to run for it, but you couldn't outrun the gas, and they just fell and died where they were. So that had happened in 56. Now, the men, I mean, this was the only work in town, and a lot of the men loved the work, and a lot of them loved the mine and called it she, like sailors talking about a ship. You know, she's taking on water, or she's shaky today. So men, even men who had survived 56, went back down in the mine, and some of the same guys were caught again in 58. What blocked them in 58 was not gas, but rock. What happened in 58 was two groups of men were trapped. There was a group of 12 men walled in together, and just in the book I just call it the group of 12, because finally what I had to work with underground, Vic, was I had 18 men finally in total darkness. They were from the same place. They did the same job. They had the same accent. Some of them even had the same names, and the lights are out. It was really a great aesthetic challenge, because how do you keep these guys apart? I mean, if you're writing a novel in perfect daylight, you might not want 18 major characters. I've got these 18 guys, and it's dark, you know.
Well, it was pretty easy to tell which was which, because they were in various states of distress.
Right. And they reacted to the events really differently. Although my husband has said this would make a cheap movie for some filmmaker, because most of it's just in the dark, and you could just make it like a radio play, you know, just voices. I'm really thirsty.
Which was the key concern was thirst.
It was. For the first 3 days, in both these groups, one of the really interesting things was that there were these two groups trapped, and they didn't know about each other, but the same situations happened, and the same kind of new social hierarchy evolved in both groups, and that was something of great interest to some researchers much later, and it was of great interest to me, too. How did the guys sort themselves out down there? The guys who became the leaders were not necessarily who anyone would have picked going in as, you know, that's the guy I'll turn to in a scrape. What happened in both groups was for the first 3 days, they thought they could get out, and they were hell-bent on getting out. The guys who weren't injured tried to get out, and there were men in each group, the group of 12 and group of 7, who sort of ended up being the de facto leaders. They picked up the picks and headed out, just determined to bang or climb or squeeze or find an exit. And the other men followed. The men who became the, quote, escape leaders weren't super bright or verbal. They didn't have great vocabularies. They weren't that popular, but somehow at this moment they were the ones who figured they could get out, and the others figured they, if anyone could find a way out, it would be them. So in both groups there were these escape leaders, and for the first 3 days the men plowed through the food, water, and the batteries for their headlamps. They would have lots of opportunity later to lament that they had not rationed the water, but to do that would have meant they would have had to say early on, we might be in here a long time, why don't we go slow on the resources? And that was inconceivable to them. The thought was just that we got to get out of here. They were panicky about getting out because poison gas could sweep in at any moment. That's what usually happened in a disaster. So they were really feeling urgent about escaping. So they tried every trick they knew, every tool, every angle, and they ate up the last bits of sandwiches in their lunch pails, and they drank up all the water. And at the end of the third day, in both groups, they were out of everything, out of food, water, and light. Now, in both groups, the guys who had been these escape leaders fell into despair, mm-hmm. and they had nothing more to offer. And from that point on, in both groups, those guys would just occasionally mutter, "We're going to die in here," mm-hmm. because it was over for them. You know, they couldn't. Now, if they'd gotten out at that point, they would have been heroes. You know,
so much for leadership, huh?
Yeah.
My guest is Melissa Faye Green. The book is Last Man Out, The Story of the Spring Hill Mine Disaster. Now, these guys, they referred to mine number two as a woman. They called the mine she, and they had an inkling, some of them, that there was something about to happen.
Yeah, they weren't happy with the structure of the mine. The way it was built made a lot of them nervous, and the old-timers in particular used to warn that the mine was shaky now. I was in Canada last week on the book tour, Vic, and at one of the book signings I had in Halifax, a man came up and said that although he hadn't grown up in Spring Hill, a lot of his family was there, and he used to visit all the time. He had uncles there, and he said he remembered them saying, "Something's going to blow here. This is not the arrangement we want." So they were worried, but they weren't cowardly, and part of the miners' code that they lived by was not to complain and not to express fear, and they weren't big talkers, so they did the job that was expected of them, and they put up with these engineered renovations in the mine, although they were unhappy with it.
And we have all these stories taking place, and I'm wondering how you did the research. You found a treasure trove of tapes, didn't you?
I did. I was worried because when I started interviewing folks, it was nothing like interviewing Southerners. I mean, you ask a Southerner a question, and he or she will go on the rest of the afternoon and into the night, you know, while occasionally refilling your glass of sweet iced tea. And I never had any problem before. I thought you just show up with a tape recorder and you're home free, and 4 days later, you know, you get back to your car and drive home. But these guys were not like that, and the coal miners of Nova Scotia are not so chatty. And I would ask, you know, a guy something, and he'd think about it a while and then say, yep. Or then, you know, it's like, well, was it kind of like this? Was it working like this? You know, nope. And there was a bench outside of town that they used to call the Liar's Bench, uh-huh. and I couldn't imagine whoever sat on that. I couldn't even picture what they would call a Liar's Bench in Nova Scotia, you know. And I would beg them, I'd say, because they said the old-timers who could really tell tall tales were gone. And I'd say, well, what, you know, do you remember some of the stories they used to tell?
Yep.
Nope. You know? Or right. Or they even say yep. And then that was it for that story, you know. Uh-huh. But what I learned was that because 1958 was the era of the Cold War, and because many people were worried that the nuclear superpowers were going to wipe each other out and we'd all be left with a nuclear winter and have to live underground, when men came up from this underground disaster, they were a source of great curiosity to psychologists and sociologists. And, well, I guess we're kind of jumping ahead because we didn't talk about the rescue yet, but after men were discovered, these professors from a couple of Nova Scotia universities descended on the town and interviewed the men in great, great detail to understand all of this. What is it like to live underground? How does human society take place? You know, all of this stuff. Tested the men, vocabulary, cognition, all of this stuff, and came back a year later and did it again, and then again a year later. So I then just had the task of trying to see if these interviews were still out there anymore from 1958, 59, and 60. And I located them. They were in the archives at the University of Toronto. And once I found these old boxes, the moment I opened these boxes, I knew I was home free.
You did it. Wow.
All the voices were there. And some of those men who had since died, who I didn't get to meet, there were a couple of them who were talkers. I mean, you don't need a room full of talkers, but if you can just have somebody that notices the quality of light or what it smelled like or just, you know, just, and there were a few. There were a few who really talked.
Is that how you got the carrot story? Was that on one of the tapes about the carrot? Someone had remembered a carrot attached to a machine.
Right. I think that came from one of my interviews, actually.
Oh, I love that story.
Old Lester, we used to call him Rabbit. Just to tell the listeners when they were just really beginning to feel terrible thirst and starvation and just sat racking their heads for what they could eat. Someone remembered there was a guy they always called Rabbit as a nickname because he used to like to bring a carrot to work. And they made their way through the dark and rubble and found a carrot near where this guy worked and came back and shared this carrot out, you know, 12 ways. Each person just got this little morsel, just a few molecules of carrot to roll around on his tongue, and they just, you know, smacked their lips on it. It was just a feast. And, mm-hmm. you know, old Lester, I always called him Rabbit.
This book really drove home to me how we live such comfortable, safe lives, and we really don't risk our lives like these guys did on a daily basis. And we take fresh water and food and our own personal safety so much for granted. And we have this poor guy whose arm is trapped. And just listening to him, being trapped down there and listening to this guy begging them, please, cut off my arm.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
That was really the worst. And that was happened to the group of seven. They were going through everything else the men were enduring in the group of 12, trying to get out, thirst, hunger, darkness. But Percy Rector, just this beloved guy, a big bear of a man, generous, awoke after the bump to see that the mine had closed on his arm. Everyone was knocked out by the bump, and they woke up gradually. They knew they were out for a while because when they woke up, a lot of them had wounds where the blood had dried already, so they knew they'd been out for a while. Once he woke up, he was caught. He was in a standing slouch, caught, just held in this wall. The wall, a wall that hadn't existed before, now had closed over his arm with a mile of earth on top of it. And he was screaming. And, you know, it made me remember a time I slammed my hand in the hinge of a car door and how frantic you are to get to the handle and get the door open and get your hand out of there. And he couldn't get it out. And the men pushed at it and looked at it, and there was nothing they could do. And he begged them to cut off his arm. It made me think of this man who was just rescued a few days ago. Or he wasn't rescued. He walked out, the man who cut off his own arm mm-hmm. with a penknife to get out mm-hmm. And then rappelled down that mountain. That's what Percy wanted them to cut off his arm. And they were terrified to do it. It just seemed to them it would have killed him instantly. And there was nothing they could do for him. And he screamed. And then after about 3 days, he started hallucinating. And he was hallucinating water because he was as thirsty as the others. And it was driving them wild. He hallucinated that he was near a mountain stream and that he was catching the droplets of water off the stream. And then he hallucinated that he was bringing a horses and wagon down to a brook and dipping up buckets of water, and he'd say, "Don't worry, boys, I'll get you some water." And they couldn't get away. They were pinned in there with him, and they just sat there with their heads down, their hands over their ears, just moaning. Finally, there were a couple of days of the only sound out of Percy was this ragged, ragged breathing, just this, mm-hmm. you know, which went longer and longer between breaths. So sometimes it went so long they thought Percy was gone, but then they'd suddenly hear, you know, he was still going. And then finally, and by then they're in this pure darkness, just the most utter darkness on earth. And suddenly one of the men said, "Percy's gone. I just saw him go. I just saw light leave his body." And they felt for his pulse, and he was dead. And the man said, "You won't believe me, but I swear to God, I just saw him die." So that was really a terrible, and gave that group an especially haunted sense of survivor's guilt the rest of their lives.
I really got wrapped up in this story, and when these guys are finally close to being saved, when they finally establish some contact, the thing they really want everybody to know is how thirsty they are. Get us something to drink. And when you describe when they actually get some water and then some coffee and some tomato soup, I mean, that just brought tears to my eyes. Just that feeling, that sensation. And when you talk about how the coffee just made them feel like they were okay.
Yeah. By then they were human again. You know, there's an African phrase of farewell. People say to one another, "Drink water." And I thought about this now in that context, because for them it was life itself was water. When the rescuers first realized there were men alive and signaled to the men that they were coming, and the men said, "Send us water." And the rescuers said, "Just sit tight. We'll get to you. We're going to come, you know, we'll get there." And the men said, if you don't send water, don't bother coming, because we won't live that long. Yeah, I mean, even 40 years later now, it was that thirst. They were praying to die by gas rather than by thirst. That would have been a more tranquil, they thought. They could just go to sleep.
Yeah. Now, you started this interview by telling us about how you kind of came in the back door on this whole story with this governor of Georgia. This guy, I was not familiar with him, but apparently he was a racist extraordinaire. And when I heard the story of him going to Little Rock to try to stick his nose into the desegregation down there and the statements this guy made and the way he ran his campaigns, I mean, he's just a classic hardcore Southern governor from the 50s, isn't he?
He was. He created the state flag that we are still fighting over in Georgia, the flag with the Confederate battle emblem on it, meant to defy the Supreme Court's desegregation order. Governor Griffin's attorney general issued the ruling that Supreme Court judgment actually did not apply to the state of Georgia, that Georgia didn't have to follow that. In 57, Georgia Tech was invited to the Sugar Bowl, and Griffin ordered, you know, 24 tickets, and then he found out the Tech was to face University of Pittsburgh, who had a black quarterback, and then Griffin forbade Georgia Tech from going to the Sugar Bowl and you know, bellowed, "The South stands at Armageddon," and gave one of his great speeches. "I am not for segregation 75%. I am not for segregation 85%. I am for segregation 100%, you know. And the Georgia Tech students rioted and marched on the state capitol building and put buckets over the statues of the Confederate general, the Confederate general statue's head. So this was Griffin. He was off hunting moose in Saskatchewan at the time of the Spring Hill mine disaster, so he missed it. But his young aide, a man named Sam Caldwell, who later became labor commissioner and then later still went to prison for improprieties in office, Sam, this young man, was watching this thing on the news because it was one of the world's first televised disasters, broadcast live all over the United States, live from the pithead. So Caldwell had this great PR idea. What if we invite the survivors of the Spring Hill mine disaster, and at that point they knew about the 12 men, they'd found the 12 men underground, what if we invite them to recuperate on sunny Jekyll Island, Georgia? Won't the whole world's media follow, and then folks will know to come and vacation in Georgia and stop going to Florida all the time. It was a great PR idea. He could not reach the governor, who was hunting moose. He was terrified Florida would jump on this thing first, and Florida would beat him to this great thing. So he couldn't stand it. So he sent a telegram to Spring Hill: "The great state of Georgia welcomes you. Come recuperate." And he called to follow it up, asked to speak to the men. He said, "Well, they're still underground, eh? But we'll give them the message." Then it was wonderfully well received, Caldwell told me. He's deceased now, but I was able to interview him a couple of times. $1 million free publicity, big story. It also was carried all over the world. You know, London Times, Paris Match, Life Magazine, they'll go to Georgia. Then Griffin came back out from Saskatchewan, saw Georgia in the headlines, what's it doing there, came home, and then 7.5 days after the disaster, really when hope was gone, there was no thought of finding anyone else alive, the rescuers who kept digging discovered another group of men, and this was the group of seven. By now, Percy Rector had died, hanging from the wall, but there were 6 men alive. They brought these men up, and the last man out was black, and it now became a PR disaster for the state of Georgia.
Well, they didn't really know he was black yet, did they?
Well, they knew in Spring Hill.
But they didn't know in Georgia.
No, it took another day because there was a cover story in the Toronto Star about Maurice Ruddock and his 12 children, and he was described in the newspaper as a mulatto or as a Negro. They always said either Negro or mulatto, and that's what the governor saw, and he went berserk. Mm. Now, tried to imagine what Griffin said when he first found out, but I couldn't get Caldwell to exactly tell me that, but it would have been vulgar. It would have been,
sure,
you know, holy, you know, some.
Yeah.
But he did say, "I will not shake hands with a Negro." He almost fired Caldwell. He was so angry. And then he sent Sam Caldwell down to Brunswick, Georgia, which is near Jekyll Island. And Jekyll Island, is the Georgia coast is, by the way, just the prettiest place on earth. But He sent Caldwell down to Brunswick to figure it out because Jekyll was white only. There was a brand new motel, white only. The entire state was segregated. And what Caldwell figured out to do was to pull a house trailer out from Brunswick and park it at the far end of Jekyll Island to put the African-Canadian coal mine hero and his family in the trailer far from the whites.
How thoughtful. The whole thing is bizarre.
I know.
And we have to realize, listeners have to understand that at the time, the reason why they wanted to do this was because Florida was a tourist destination, and all these tourists would be passing through Georgia, getting lost on their way to try to find Florida. And Georgia really didn't have a tourism industry, and they were trying to develop one.
They were. The tourism industry consisted in fleecing the Yankees as they drove through. And that's a lot of the scenes in my first book, In Praying for Sheetrock, is about that. It's about these unsuspecting Yankees traveling down through these rural counties who set up their entire industries to trap the Yankees. In McIntosh County, which is what I wrote about, In Praying for Sheetrock, they had clip joints all along the highway, which were these little whitewashed shacks that seemed to be offering, you know, peaches or peanuts, and your northern family would pull over to get a sack of something and would be told inside, purchase a $5 or more, give you a free throw of the dice. Mm-hmm. And there were these gambling games set up in these little clip joints, these little whitewashed shacks, and people lost all their vacation money. People lost all their retirement money. People would go back into their cars and open the trunks and be getting money, you know, get rubber money that was wrapped in rubber bands inside of black socks. They were digging into their money, couldn't hand it over fast enough. These games were so rigged, and you got so close to winning, and it just looked like, you know, you were going to make your fortune, and instead people just came away from that completely empty-handed. And if they had their wits about them a bit, they would pull into the county seat of Darien and find their way to the sheriff's office to complain, and there, I mean, they would just be laughed out of the office. The sheriff owned the land the clip joints sat on. So that was how McIntosh County handled the tourists. Long County, next door to McIntosh, handled the tourists by having a speed trap there. And it was AAA's most famous to be avoided speed trap. And what they had in Long County was a traffic light that would go directly from green to red without ever going through yellow when a Yankee was right underneath it. And what I was told by people who lived in Ludowice, that was the county seat, was, they had a button could let you get up to and mash it when a Yankee was directly underneath. And, I mean, so that's what they were doing with the tourists in South Georgia. Mm. But there was hope to have a tourist industry that would involve, you know, beaches.
You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook. That was Melissa Faye Green, recorded 16 years ago, talking about her book Last Man Out, the story of the Spring Hill Mine disaster. You're listening to WYSO, your home for independent news and hand-picked music. And Melissa has made a number of appearances on the program. Most recently, last year, when I interviewed her for a special Book Nook on the Road at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs. Thanks for listening to The Best of the Book Nook.